Hello, this is HM correspondent Erica Dulcinea Diggs for the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network. Today, we're speaking with Luke Forbes. Last time we spoke with Forbes, it was for World Development Information Day, his work in community activism, and more. Today, we're speaking about a case of a 14-year-old boy who was threatened and how we can label race as a public health crisis. How are you doing today, Mr. Forbes?
How are you guys doing?
We're good. Great to see you again, of course.
It's good to see you again, too.
All right. So, how does systematic racism affect Black Americans?
Systematic racism affects Black Americans in numerous different ways. What we're seeing now is that the Black community has still been subject to the same treatments that they were subject to years ago. Just the terminologies and name has repatterned and renamed. Mm-hmm. When you see slavery as a thing of the past, it's still something that goes on today. It's just known today as involuntary servitude.
Right.
So we're seeing that go on in our prison systems where they're having people literally work as welders, as electricians, as chemists, where they were recently just making all the hand sanitizer for the state of New York during the pandemic. Yet these people are getting paid pennies and being forced into working environments. When we even look at it, like let's say our license plate, for instance, something that's so commonly known across New York State is only factoried in prisons. And that's a whole budget that if it was to be contract outside of the prisons, they would have to pay people state employee benefits. They'll have to pay people actual salaries as factory workers and engineers and things like that. Unfortunately, because this slavery component still is in our Constitution, where they're able to put people as indigenous servants when they commit crimes, it kind of subjects that to them being come slaves. Now, that brings me to the reason why slavery and police brutality and all these different things are so interconnected. When we look at our communities that have been redlined for generations and allowed to dilapidate, where the properties are being allowed to just go under, be condemned by absentee landlords, who are also known as slum lords in our neighborhoods. They allow these properties to just be condemned and things like that. Code enforcement isn't really enforcing the code on these absentee landlords in poverty communities that are also considered to be redlined, where banks don't give mortgages or really invest in those part of the communities, and they kind of restrict those areas and from big investments. So you see these poverty communities just continuously being broken down. And these are also the communities that are over-policed, where the police are told to go here. Mm-hmm. Now, they take out good living housing situations. So people are living in housing situations that are poor. And then you also put in the fact that communities are also lowered in the actual opportunities, Albany being one of the worst cities in the country to raise a Black child, according to the Child Opportunities Index. For that to also signify in these impoverished communities that are also redlined and also over-policed, it makes it more of a environment, breeding environment for their slaves in the prison industry, because this is where they breed the slaves. They take out the opportunities, they take out the decent living situations, and they only put in drugs. Like JP Morgan actually just got caught smuggling over $2.9 billion worth of heroin last year, and no one was even charged with that situation, because the boat, the shipping company was out in Switzerland, actually shipped it over here. The JP Morgan just financed it. So they kind of had no actual legal grounds to arrest anyone in that situation. But it's companies like that that smuggle large amounts of drugs and other illegal substances into our communities that are the only opportunities in these communities. And people are overcharged and put into prisons. So really, public health racism systematically affects people when it comes to housing, when it comes to education, when it comes to employment, when it comes to police brutality and the overall criminal justice system itself. Another thing that's not being taken into consideration when it comes to African Americans and the criminal justice system is mitigating factors. They normally only take mitigating factors into full consideration when it's dealing with white counterpart who may have done something similar that a Black counterpart would receive more time in a situation for.
Right.
So these are the ways that racism still affects the Black community systematically.
And could you tell us more about the father who was pressured to protect his family after his 14-year-old son was targeted by a gang?
So out in the city of Albany, there has been over 118 shootings throughout the summer. A father, his son actually was directly targeted by a gang where situations kind of started to escalate from them just picking on him in passing to pulling knives out on him at the mall to them actually shooting at their house with paintball bullets and then leading up to actual real bullets. And they just was doing that for the time span of a couple of months. After the actual lethal rounds went through their household and the father and his father-in-law trying so hard to reach out to ADP, the county executive, Dan McCoy, and other city officials about getting police in their area, because they continuously tell us that they need more police, they need more police. Well, they have all these police, yet these police aren't walking their beat. They're not sitting in on the blocks. They're not doing the things that they say that they're doing. So really what we're doing is we're paying for an unnecessary thing. The police only show up after crime happens or to commit crimes themselves. So that's what we're seeing right now in our communities. And this father, after his household, like I said, was shot up and a bullet zipped past one of his daughter's heads and smashing into her laptop while she was actually on it, ended up going to get a legal firearm because he was also labeled a felon from a case that was committed 20 years prior. So he was unable to take the proper safety protocols and one day was trying to grab the gun and it accidentally went off and striked his daughter in the back. And she was outside of the household when that happened. He was in the household and they're trying to give the father 3.5 to 7 years currently for this situation, trying to stress the factor that it was a legal gun, ignoring the mitigating factors that he just got a weapon to protect his household from these gangs that have been targeting his son for the past couple of months, and the police not doing anything even after they have been given names and other information about the situation. So currently that is what he's facing, and the community is really calling for mitigating factors to be taken into consideration into this case, where this father wasn't doing anything explicit. He wasn't trying to harm his kids. His daughter actually fully recovered, and she wrote letters to the judge herself expressing that she doesn't want her father to go to prison. I've recently just sat down with the whole family and did an interview, and all of them would be heartbroken. Even the family closest friends would be heartbroken if this father was to go to prison for 3.5 years. And surely with all the pressure being placed on this 14-year-old son, who's kind of feels like he's the cause of all this situation, he probably may be in a gang where we see that the absence of Black fathers causes kids to really kind of lose that real substance in the household. You kind of need both parents, and it will break that down. So right now, the community is calling for those mitigating factors to be taken into consideration, where this father literally tried everything that he could try and then just went about it like any American would go about it and try to utilize the Second Amendment, which unfortunately some people are persecuted against from actions committed 20 years ago.
Yeah, I totally understand. It's weird that you mentioned the taking the father out of the home. That was my initial first thought when you told me his time frame that he could go to jail or prison for. So definitely, you definitely need both parents in the household to have a proper functioning household. You know, mm-hmm. Personally, from my own experience, you know, I feel like, you know, there are some people that come out of single mom situated homes and are great, but you know, it's very hard to keep someone balance without both parent figures. You know what I mean?
Yes.
Okay. So what was your first reaction when you heard this story?
My first reaction when I heard this story was I seen it in the Times Union newspaper and they gave it a completely different headline and it kind of was kind of misleading. It just made it seem like a father had a legal firearm and just shot his daughter. But when you really start hearing about what was going on with this family, the amount of pressure that was put on this father and the things that went on in this case, you really have to also feel for the family. Again, there's been 118 shootings in the city of Albany. I just can only imagine how someone would feel if their family was directly targeted within that time. And then also, like, when we look around the country, there's this tension of race wars, and then it's being the highest sale of guns in America in years. Mm-hmm. So we have to take all these things into consideration, and we just can't make it seem like, oh, it was just this father who felt the need to protect his family. No, a bunch of Americans across the country are feeling the need to protect their families, especially I asked a few of his neighbors, and a lot of them agree with him. I'm also going around with a survey to get some information on how people feel, and a lot of them feel the same way that this father felt. he was just trying to protect his family, and I feel like those mitigating factors weren't taken into consideration. So upon first hearing about this case, I was confused as to why the media was trying to hide those mitigating factors. And then upon learning those mitigating factors, I can only do what I'm doing now and just try to cause attention to those.
Okay, so for those whom are white, where do we look for guidance in matters of race and racism?
I would say that ask a friend, ask a stranger. We need to stop putting barriers on conversations. When you put a barrier on a conversation and you go into a conversation kind of not sure whether or not that's the conversation that you want to have, it will only make it weird. And we kind of need to cut this ice, this fog, this smog, this border, whatever it is that's dividing us. We need to cut it. And we need to just break this tension. Because at the end of the day, I feel as if every human being wants to be a good human being. And we need to just separate ourselves from those who want to be bad human beings. I'm trying to work out.
So let's throw in your podcast. Where can people check you out? How do people reach you?
No. So you can definitely look us up on Silent Majority NY. And you can even check us out on Facebook. We're also at the Silent Majority on there. You can look me up on my Facebook at Lukey Forbes. As well, you can also find me on Instagram at Lukey Forbes as well.
All right, folks, you heard it here. This was part two of a four-part segment with Lukey Forbes. We spoke about racism and a 14-year-old boy who was threatened by a gang. This has been HM correspondent Erica Diggs. Thank you so much.